Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 393 premium for Thursday, April 19th, 2012.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, we provide some answers, we provide some tips, we do some research on your behalf, and together, the goal is to all learn quite a few things new each time. Here in sunny Durham, New Hampshire, in the morning, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Awesome. How you doing, John?
Just getting the coffee going here.
All right. Yeah, it's just shortly after 9 a.m. for John and I today, which is earlier than usual for us, but a good time to podcast. Don't you think?
Sure.
All right. Perhaps we should just dive right in and then let the show take us where it shall. Craig writes, my favorite Mac geeks, I have a situation I thought you might find interesting. I have a 27-inch iMac purchased just after the first of the year. It has a 256 gig SSD as a boot drive and a 1 terabyte conventional hard drive for data. That's my data drive. As you might suspect, it has nothing on it but data. That is my iTunes library, photos, etc. I noticed that the data drive will spin up throughout the day, seemingly at random, even though I am not accessing any of the data stored there. It just spins up, I can hear it, and then eventually goes back to sleep. I tend to work with one app at a time, so I don't think it has to do with some other app running in the background. This has not been a real problem, just an annoyance, but actually it does become a problem at night. After the iMac goes to sleep, my UPS shuts off power to several of my peripherals, like my speakers and a few others, and then everyone happily goes to sleep. The problem is, even when the iMac's asleep, that data drive spins up randomly throughout the night, and when my UPS senses the extra current required to spin up the drive, it clicks a relay, and all the peripherals turn on. The iMac screen stays blank, and the iMac does not seem to wake up, just the drive spins up. I know all this because I sleep a few feet from my iMac and it sometimes wakes me up. I don't think it has anything to do with other drives because I turn them off at night. I also know about the daily script that runs, but this problem occurs at random times. I do have the preferences set to wake on LAN, but the computer does not wake up. And here's the real info. If I unmount the data drive, the problem goes away. This brings up another question, which would become moot for me if you figure out a solution to the problem above. Is there a way to mount and unmount the internal drive without rebooting? All right. So let's talk about a couple of things here that would happen. Number one, if that drive internal to your Mac is spinning up, your Mac is awake. The screen may not wake up, but your Mac is awake. And then by your Mac being awake, it lights up the rest of the peripherals because it's drawing more current. But that drive internal there is not going to spin up if your iMac is asleep. I have the same iMac, actually exact same setup, 256 and 1 terabyte, both internal, but mine's not in my bedroom. It's across the driveway in the office here. So it's certainly waking up for some reason. So you could check the console logs at those times to see, if there's anything there that indicates that it's waking it up. One other thing to bear in mind, Time Machine will back up all internal drives that are internal to your Mac, not just the boot drive. So it's possible that what's randomly waking the drive up is that your hourly Time Machine backups are going. Now, those shouldn't happen while your Mac is asleep. But if the Mac is awake, then the Time Machine backups will happen and those will spin that drive up to scan it to pull all the new data off of it. So you could use Time Machine Editor, which is a favorite utility of ours, right, John? And that will let you increase that hourly interval or set a fixed schedule for backing up. So that's number one. I'm trying to think. So we've got those two. It's possible that drive has something in it that would spin it up, but I don't think that would be happening. As far as mounting, just because it's from an Apple, and my guess is they've got the firmware right, for their computers. As far as mounting a drive, once you've unmounted it, Disk Utility will do that for you. In fact, Disk Utility will unmount too, but of course it's easy enough to unmount by dragging it to the trash. But yeah, Disk Utility, you'll see it and you can select it and mount it. If you want something a little more readily at hand, there are menu bar utilities that will do it. The one I always use is the one built into iStat menus, which allows you to see all connected disks, whether or not they are mounted, and then you can choose to mount them if you like. So that's any thoughts on this, John?
A few thoughts. So one, though it may be obvious here, an energy saver, you want to make sure. Put hard disks to sleep when possible is checked, though I assume that's the case here.
Yeah, good point. Yep.
So just to make sure. It wasn't clear to me what, let me go back here, what brand of drive this is.
Well, I would say that probably doesn't matter because it's factory installed from Apple.
Oh, the drive's inside of the machine.
Yes.
Okay.
Like I said, it's similar to my setup. So yeah, the way Apple does it is you can either get a regular drive, an SSD, or you can get what they call a flash storage and then a regular drive as well. And that's what I have is I've got 256 gigs of flash storage, and I don't know, I haven't cracked it open or I haven't looked at the iFixit thing. I probably should. To see how that's configured. But my guess is it's not in the form of a drive enclosure. I think it's just, you know, mounted somewhere inside the machine, the flash enclosure, and then the flash memory. And then there's another drive. So yeah, that's a stock, customizable configuration from, but available direct from Apple.
Okay. Cause, some external drives, and I think, I found a few articles here just searching, some WD drives, apparently require a firmware update in order to not be stupid about sleeping.
Right.
And I see an article right here. They're like, oh, you know, my WD drive wouldn't sleep. And then when I applied the latest firmware, then everything's great. So, and then of course there's an Apple article we'll link to that, it's always good to keep in mind here, but it's called Mac OS 10, Why Your Mac Might Not Sleep or Stay in Sleep Mode. And it does touch on the hard drive sleep.
Okay.
Mode. So.
Oh.
There's a lot of things in there. I'm not going to go over all of them, but it's just a good general article. If you see your Mac not sleeping when you want it to, this can help tell you why. Well, or we have that article. Yeah. Well, we'll have to link to this article. There actually is a way. I think, is it PM set? You can run PM set machine will tell you why you can't sleep.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes.
That's right. Yes. Ah, that's right. We'd stumbled onto that. It'll tell you if it can't sleep if it's an app that's that's doing it. So yeah, you I've found the article here, John. You use PM set what is it? PM set dash G.
G?
Yeah,
G.
Yeah, dash G, and it'll tell you if sleep is imposed by a process, which is certainly helpful. That can tell you if there's time. Actually, backup D can do it. Audio processes can do it. So yeah, we'll put a link to that article in the show notes. That's a good one. I'd forgotten about that. Smart sleep would be another thing to use to kind of, you know, and you can do it from the command line with PM set, of course, but smart sleep makes it easier if you don't want to muck with the terminal to really kind of get a better handle on your sleep settings. Very handy for portable owners, especially portable owners with spindle drives. But I guess perhaps there are less and less of those now as Apple's selling more and more SSD based portables. I think that will be something that will happen very soon, that we will see the end of all mechanical drive based portables. I predict within the next 18 months.
No.
Why no?
I'm going to keep mine.
Well, no. I don't mean that they'll come and take yours away from you. I mean that they just won't be selling anymore. Is that? No.
Okay.
Okay.
No, I think they are going to take mine away.
That's for different reasons, though.
Actually, I just got a Momentous XT I'm looking at.
That's the hybrid?
Pretty neat so far. Yes. Yeah, they shipped one out to me.
That's right. You said that. Yeah.
So, yeah, the first thing I did last night, I actually installed Lion Fresh on it because I do want to make sure I get the recovery partition on the drive. I'm doing a clone.
Out of curiosity, does Lion see that Does Lion see that that drive should support trim? Or actually, I guess it probably wouldn't because it's not a pure SSD, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it does. Yeah, I think only and you got to do a hack or something, but I don't think I should enable trim on this.
No, I think that would be a bad idea now that I'm kind of talking it out. That's right.
Yeah. All right. On to Joe.
You got Joe?
I got Joe.
You
got Joe. Well, I got a cup of Joe, and I'm going to read something from Joe. And it's a short and sweet question here. Guys, how do I get latitude and longitude data from a picture taken by my iPhone 4S? Get info doesn't do it. No, it does not. It would be nice if it did. I mean, it displays a lot of info about a photo, but apparently that is, not that.
That is surprising that Get Info doesn't show that. But like you said, it doesn't. So be it. Yes.
So here's what you want to do if you do want to get this data. So number one, this is not always embedded. So if you do want, and this is a tip because you may be. So in this case, Joe absolutely wants the data in there. Now, what some people may not know is that you may want to turn this off. You may not want to have your location embedded in photos you take on your iPhone or other device. And at least on the iPhone, if you go to the settings and location services, you can turn location services on or off for the camera application. So if you want the data, turn it on. If you turn it off, it will not embed the GPS data.
That makes sense. And I would add to that, if you use a third-party camera app, this is also kind of a system-wide place where you could ensure that that app is also not going to embed your data. So your location data. Yeah.
And then, so once you bring the photo over to the Mac, well, the easiest application to use to view this data, I find, is Preview. Huh. And in Preview, you go to Tools, Show Inspector, and then you'll see a number of tabs of the data in the photo. And if there's GPS data, you'll see a little GPS tab. You click on that, it's going to show on a world map where the location is. And, you know, that may be kind of hard to see, but there's a little locate button. And if you click on that, it'll then bring you to Google Maps and show you the location of that's embedded in the photo. And of course, any modern, you know, Aperture and Lightroom and all, and I think even iPhoto, you know, if the data is in there and you click on the right tab, I don't have the specifics, but you can see that data as well. But I find Preview is a nice way to do it quick and dirty.
Huh. Look at that. Hey, that's handy stuff, man. Wow. It's totally right.
Yeah, I like how it goes to Google Map. So yeah. It opens it up in the browser. That's pretty slick.
I found a picture that actually was synced to my Dropbox camera uploads folder, and it was one that I took about a year ago. And man, I mean, it zoomed. I know right where I was when I took this picture, and it's obviously got it right there. Okay, so now I have a follow-up question for you, John. Suppose I wanted to share this picture with, let's say, you, but I didn't want the location of this to be embedded in this picture. It already is there, right? I can't go to location services and turn it off. It doesn't matter because it's already embedded in this picture that I took. How do I scrub this data out of there? And I know you're not prepared for this, but you know, this is a good discussion.
No, I am because I knew you were going to ask this.
Really? That's awesome.
Graphic Converter will offer things in the services menu.
Okay.
And one of the choices will let you strip out select data. So that's one. And then the different applications, Aperture does, I don't have the exact sequence in front of me, but if you dig around, you can also scrub that data out of the picture.
Ah, okay.
But off the top of my head, that is, let me right click here and see. So if I right click on a photo, services, remove metadata.
Oh.
That's something the Graphic Converter provides. And if you click on that, one of the choices, I think, will be all EXIF data. I don't think you can specifically remove just the location data, but you can scrub all the non-photo data if you want to.
That's cool.
Maybe you can with Preview. I've just never tried it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking. I don't think you can with Preview. Yeah, I'm looking here to see if there's a way, but I don't. Yeah. Oh, you know what? We came up with something else once. It's EXIF data, right? And there was, I thought there was like a, I thought we had like some little EXIF scrubber thing, but that's not the right name for it. But there was something.
There's something called the let me see here. I haven't used this in a while. Something called EXIF editor.
Okay. Yeah. I wonder if that would do it.
No, I think it will. I'm looking here. I haven't used this in a while. EXIF editor, view EXIF data, edit, create, editor, create. Okay. So I would think edit includes deleting.
Yeah. And what's, and what utility is that?
Is this even for Mac here? I'm looking. EXIF pilot was the first one I came up with.
Oh, okay. I found one called Photo Linker, that will let you edit your geotags. And part of that is that you can remove them. So I'll pop that into the show notes or into the Skype chat for you to put in the show notes.
All right.
Cool. All right. Well, that was good. So, this in a beautiful moment of synchronicity, I just mentioned the Dropbox camera uploads, which was actually the subject of our next question, because we talked about how great it was that if you turned on Dropbox camera uploads, you could then upload your pictures and get extra Dropbox space just for uploading them. And then you could remove them from there. And Rick wrote, following the instruction in the last show, I was able to upload images in order to get the additional 5 gigs of space. Good stuff. I now have a question. You mentioned that I could delete the images and keep the additional space, but I really don't want images to upload each time I insert my memory card into my Mac. How do I turn off the auto uploading of images in Dropbox? What you're going to do, Rick, is you are going to go to the Dropbox little menu bar icon and go to preferences. And then there you're going to go to general. And from general, you will uncheck the bottom button or bottom checkbox, which is enable Dropbox camera support. And that will stop Dropbox from pestering you every time you plug in a camera or anything that appears like a camera, which would be your memory card too, because it's going to see that that's, you know, got pictures on it. So that's the easy way to do it. And I love it when things sync up like that, John. That's a beautiful thing.
Indeed.
Indeed. All right. Oh, John, I've got one for you here. Let me read this question, because not only does our listener Kenneth or Ken want this, but I want this too. So Ken writes, some months ago, I tried out Cobook as an address book replacement. It caused crashing, so I removed the installation. Now, all of a sudden, address book calls from other apps are going to Cobook. How do I go about deregistering it as the default application for address book stuff? I vaguely recall that there was a system pref pane for this, but I haven't had any luck Googling for it. There's no setting in WhoPaste, which is the app that he's using, and Addressbook doesn't have a preference, like, say, Safari, for choosing your default browser. Thanks for whatever you can suggest. And I have the same need, but for different reasons. I've got movies are now opening in, links are now opening in the wrong apps. And so I need to know how to do this too. And it used to be RC default app, John, but I don't know if that works with Lion. So I turn to you, my friend.
Well, no, you answer your own question.
Really?
That is.
Okay.
Yeah, works fine. I have it on Lion. I have it on Snow Leopard and I have it on Lion. I think the place you want to go in that program, so it's called RC default apps.
Mm-hmm.
If you search for that, you'll find it. And it's from Rubicon. I think
Rubicon or Rubicode, right?
Rubicode.
Yeah.
All right. Actually, let me bring up my notes here again. All right. And I think that there's two sections that you want to look here, either the apps section.
Okay.
And if you click on that, it'll show different applications, including address book, and then it'll show a little checkbox for what file types are associated with that. And I think you can fiddle with that. Or there's also an extensions section, which shows which when a file has a certain extension, what app is going to launch. So between those two, I think you'll be able to correct the behavior of this.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. All right. And it works for you online.
Yeah,
awesome.
Comes up, okay. No problem.
I had seen version 2.1 hasn't been updated since September of 2009, so that's what gave me pause when I saw this question come in. Is there anything else? I thought, was there something in, does the secrets pref pane also let you edit these things, John? I seem to remember you found something else. But maybe, I don't know. What do I know? That's why I'm asking.
Secrets,
you.
Address book. No, I don't see anything.
It doesn't let you edit all that stuff. Okay. I know there was something else. I know we've come up with something else other than RC default app, but
I do see in secrets they do have a choice that lets you enable the debug menu in address book, though. I don't know if that's gonna do anything for you.
Huh. All right. No, I was just thinking, I thought Secrets had a way of editing the same stuff that RC default app, not just address book specific, but just, you know, in general, but maybe not. All right, cool. Well, an answer. That's what we need. That's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
Got anything else on this one? Or
No, I think that's it. It's a very interesting application because it shows you the mess of how, you know, how file types and all that are associated with applications. And it's there are a number of ways to do it. And there's also MIME types. You know, it's another way to launch an app, depending on the MIME type that it has. And that's mostly, I think, when you get stuff in email. No, I think it may also depend on, I think that ties into both stuff in the browser and email. But yeah, there's a whole list of MIME types here, and it shows what application will handle a certain MIME type. So,
that could be
another place to look here. Because actually, let me look and see if they have a application. No, I don't see one off the top of my head here that
does RC default app let me edit I guess URLs is the right term. So if something, like, for example, if you have a URL that says ITPC:// instead of HTTP:// that will open in, at least by default, in iTunes because it knows that because ITPC is registered as iTunes podcast URL. But and then also feed:// indicates that this is going to be an RSS feed. So and you can point those at different things. Will RC default app let me edit those type of things too? I'm trying to, I guess it would just be URLs. Looks like from one of the screenshots here, I can.
I don't see that. I mean, I see a way it'll let you.
Well, I see along the. So I don't have the app, but I have a screenshot up, John, and I'm seeing there is a tab for URLs between apps and extensions.
Yeah, that's not quite. That's
not what I'm looking for, huh?
Oh, maybe it is. Actually, I'm looking here. The first one it has is Acrobat. No, I think you're right. Okay, yes.
Cool.
So here, if I click on HTTP, it'll say default app Safari. Okay, perfect. No, you're right. That's it. URL. So that'll, and I think, does it have ITPC? And that will launch iTunes. Okay.
Oh, look at me go. Hey, that's awesome. Okay, so I definitely need this thing. There's no question about it. I don't know why I don't have it after you've been talking about it for, how long have we been doing this show? Almost seven years?
Well, normally you don't need to muck around with that, but it sounds like sometimes an app may change this and the app doesn't offer a way to change it back, which is kind of lame.
That is lame. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem. All right, cool. Let's hear what John has to ask. Not you, unless you have a question of your own that you'd like to ask. In which case,
I have many questions.
Okay. But
I'm not going to ask them now.
Okay. Then we'll let listener John take this one.
Hi guys, this is John from Wisconsin, and I couldn't resist having that little intro for myself in there, being that my last name kind of fits the song. Anyway, my question is with iTunes. When I'm backing up my iPhone, and I will include this screenshot, you can see there's like three or four entries if you go under Preferences and Devices. Now, generally, I back up my iPhone every week. Now, I thought there would be at least more than one or more than four entries in there. But anyway, the screenshot is there. Are there settings in iTunes? Or any thoughts would be appreciated. Thanks, guys. And here's where I'm going to do so I don't get caught.
Well, thanks for the enhanced audio comment there, John. That's we like that kind of stuff. So that's good. So, yeah, if you go into iTunes and devices, you will see the device backups, as John indicated. And for him, he's only the only device that he backs up with this machine is his iPhone. And he's right. He only sees three backups listed. And the current one is fine. But the older ones are, you know, from many years ago. One's from March of 2011. One's from February of 2011. So here's the thing about the backups on iTunes. It only keeps the most recent copy. It does not keep it does not keep incremental copies of your backups. So you can't say, oh, I need to go back to where my iPhone was 2.5 weeks ago on, you know, whatever date that would be, you know, April 1st. And that's just how this works. But you might ask, what are these other things? Well, anytime you upgrade the software on your iPhone or wipe it clean and start from scratch, it starts a new backup set for you. So when you upgrade from, you know, iOS 5 to, you know, whatever, 4 to 5, it's going to archive off your backup of iOS 4. And actually, it doesn't archive it off. It just freezes it in time and it keeps it in place. You can delete those. And in your case, John, it's been over a year. Go ahead and delete them. Those things can actually get to be pretty big, depending on how much stuff you keep on your phone and how you keep your data there. They can be many, many gigabytes in size. So it is, you know, the kind of thing that you can clean up after a while. But yeah, it does not keep iterations of backups. And that's just the way iTunes backup works. So I think that's that. Do you have any thoughts on this, John?
No, I think it's pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward. Yeah. Well, it's straightforward like many
things.
Well,
unless you see multiple ones. Yeah. I'm wondering why that happens.
Well, I guess I just said why it happens. Right?
Oh, because yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's when you do any sort of restore of your phone, it keeps the old backup and then creates a new one. That, mm-hmm. That's essentially where it comes from. All right. We've got a couple of questions about mail that we'll talk about here. Graham writes, I have a recurring issue that I do not seem to be able to solve. Periodically, my Apple Mail decides to go offline for no apparent reason, often when the computer sleeps or when the Wi-Fi network changes. I have deleted the account and added it again, but the problem recurs after a while. I've added the screenshots and error messages for info. A simple close and reopen of mail resolves the problem temporarily, but it always returns after a day or so. I'm running Lion on the latest MacBook Air and all of that good stuff. It says there's nothing obvious in the console when I search on Mail or on iCloud, so any advice would be good. And he's right. He's seeing it where the Mail account just goes offline. It starts asking for his password and saying that it's rejected. So and this is one of those things. Let's abstract it out. Away from iCloud for a second, you know, when mail starts acting like this, what can you do? And obviously looking in the console is one thing, but in this case, it's not showing him anything. Mail, though, has some good troubleshooting utilities or troubleshooting paths built into it. The first is if you go, and this will work on Snow Leopard or Lion. I know he's on Lion and probably most of you are. But if you go to the window menu, you can go to Connection Doctor. And then once you're there, and that's actually going to, even before you do the next step, that's going to show you all of your accounts that you have defined, both incoming accounts for POP and IMAP, and also outgoing accounts for SMTP. And if they don't all light up green, then that tells you that mail can't connect to them. When you open Connection Doctor, it tries to connect to everything, just to kind of give you a deal. Then you can hit show detail at the bottom. When you do that, it will begin showing you the logs of all of the connections that it's trying to make. And this can be somewhat overwhelming. It's all the raw commands that are sent back and forth to and from the mail server. But what can be really handy here is if you have one account that will not work, turn this on and then go check for mail in that account. And take a look here and see what the actual error message is. Mail is really not that great at giving you error messages. I mean, it'll tell you, it'll say the password or username and password was rejected, But it's not always good at telling you exactly what the server said back. And the server might say back, I can't, you know, can't log you in because I have a problem. Right. And you could go nuts trying to diagnose this on your own when really the mail server is telling you, hey, look, I have a problem. I can't let you in right now. You know, that kind of thing is really handy to see. So Connection Doctor in the window menu is a good is probably the best place for this type of problem, because it's going to give you a lot of information and the raw information to, you know, it's essentially a console log for mail, if you will, transaction log. The other thing to look at there is, and this probably won't help with this problem, but just in general with mail troubleshooting, is the window activity viewer. That will show you what's going on at any point in time. It's not as granular as the Connection Doctor, but it'll kind of give you an overview of, here's what I'm doing, and I have, you know, X number of connections live that I'm transacting with it at the moment. And that can also be handy, because you can see if something's stuck and you can stop it and kind of let it go. So that'll tell you in this case, if it's the server or if it's you. If it appears to be something on your Mac, that gets a little trickier, because it's recurring but not constant. Mail could be dealing with a damaged cache file or something that gets reset on app launch. I mean, you're saying that if you quit and come back in, kind of resetting that connection helps, at least for a while. You know, to me, that says run Onyx and see if that clears out your caches and see if that helps. It's certainly not going to hurt. And that might be the answer to your problems. You could have some damaged file that it's trying to write something to and it can't, and then it's getting itself out of sync. I'm conjecturing here, but that's certainly what I would do from a troubleshooting standpoint if looking at Connection Doctor didn't give me a clear answer as to what we were looking for. So those are my thoughts on this one, John. Do you have any additional?
I have one additional, because I've seen it happen over the last couple of days here. Well, you may want to go to the iCloud system status page.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And that's at apple.com/support/iCloud/system status. And look at this. Recently, on both 4.17 and 4.18, they were having problems with mail.
Hmm.
Saying users may have so look there. I gotta say I don't think I ever had a problem with Mobile Me mail servers never responding, but I've had several cases where you'll see this, you know, iCloud, some server name that has IMAP in it somewhere, and it says it's rejected. And I agree with you, the error message is wrong, because sometimes it's the servers are down or not responding to anyone. So be sure to check that page first to find out what's up.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea. That's even better than digging through the connection details, because those can be long in the tooth sometimes. Or just long in the list, I guess. All right. Moving on to Marion. Marion actually asks, he has three questions. I believe Marion is a he. If I got that wrong, my apologies. But Marion asks three questions, the first of which is very similar to this, having the same problem with Yahoo Mail. And so, at the end of it, he says, you know, sometimes I can't get my mail and I have to wipe the account and start over. And he says, when I do that, it takes a long time to pull the messages back in, as I have, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 messages on my IMAP server. And the download speed, according to the mail activity window, is about 5 kilobits per second, even though I have 100 megabits per second connection at home. Please advise. And a couple of these things are going to talk about speed, because Marion has a fast connection at home. But it's important to remember that when you have a fast network, even though the capability is for it to go at 100 megabits, latency, and that being the time that it takes to send a piece of data and then wait to hear back that the other party got it, plays a huge part when dealing with smaller files. And when you're dealing with mail, it's a very transaction heavy, very chatty thing that's happening. You're not just saying, you're not just sending one command that says, hey, I'm here, blast all my mail at me and I'll let you know when I got it. You know, what's happening is you're saying, give me a list of all the messages that I have. Okay, send me message number one. Okay, I got it. Send me message number two. Okay, I got it. And so on. So that's a very high, you know, high level of conversation that's happening there. And each one of those takes a little bit of time because you have to send it and then wait for the response and send it and wait for the response. So when you're transferring lots of small files, and this happens when you're doing a Time Machine backup over the network too, or even to a local drive, it's going to go much faster if it's backing up a large file than it will if it's backing up many, many small files. And so that's important to remember. There's nothing you can do about it, but it just is what it is. So now we're getting kind of off in the deep end, but that's where an SSD, when you're talking about doing this to a local hard drive, really, really starts to pay off, because the latency is so low on that. You can make transactions. You can make many more small transactions in a given period of time than you can with a standard, you know, traditional mechanical drive. And that's where some of the, like the hybrid drive that John's talking about here, the Momensis XT, it tries to kind of mitigate that. It uses the disk for the big storage, but tries to cache as much as possible up on this SSD portion of the drive so that your quick transactions actually happen very, very quickly. Am I too far off the map here now, John?
No, you're still on the map.
Okay, good. His second question is, he says on YouTube, this is a very recent issue, so it might be resolved before you reply, but I throw it in anyway, just to see if you've heard of it. Simply, I've been having issues using YouTube on my Mac lately. The videos take forever to load, even on the basic resolution, or they will not load at all, and all I'm getting is the YouTube spinning wheel. I've tried several browsers. I've reinstalled Safari, Flash, all with no effect. The least affected seems to be Chrome, but it's not flawless either. I've restarted both my modem and the Airport Express, but nothing helps. Is there a way to reinstall YouTube? Just in case you're wondering, it affects both embedded and YouTube site videos. Vimeo, for instance, is fine. I've seen this before. I've not seen it all that recently, but certainly, you know, maybe 6 months ago, I was seeing this constantly, more on my iPad than on my Mac. And anytime I had this problem, I changed my DNS server to a different DNS server, and then it worked fine. And as it might turn out, the one that I would default to change it to when I'm testing things is Google's DNS. And of course, Google owns YouTube, so perhaps there's more to this than just changing. But the DNS, Google's DNS server is very, very, very easy to remember, which is why I do it. It is 8.8. Get a pencil. Are you ready, folks? For the remaining two octets. .8.8. That's right. Four eights in a row. 8.8.8.8. And that's a very easy one to remember. So and you can do that on your Mac. You go into system. You have to be an administrator to do this, but you go into System Preferences, Network, and then go to whatever your connection is, be it Wi-Fi or Ethernet. Click on Advanced and then change DNS right there. The one thing I will point out is when you change DNS on your device, it may, though not always, it may screw up your ability to find other local resources, depending on how you're managing DNS in your house. So probably best not to necessarily leave it this way, but certainly good as a test. And you can do the same on your iOS devices by going into Settings, Wi-Fi, choose your Wi-Fi network. And then in the DHCP section, you can actually go and edit the DNS just by tapping on it. It's not obvious, but because it's already going to be filled in with whatever your router gave it, but you just tap on it and you can edit it right there. So handy stuff. But that always seemed to help me down my solution path when I had this weird YouTube thing. Have you ever seen that, John?
I haven't seen it, but I will suggest in the DNS world here, there is something that I looked at in the past here, but this may help identify DNS issues. And that's a utility called NameBench, code.google.com/p/NameBench. And that is a utility that will benchmark your DNS and other DNSs, including Google, I believe, is included in that, and tell you which one gives the best performance. So
that's cool. Cool.
Yeah, and as you said, you could change it. My other observation is that sometimes I think YouTube gives different priority to different videos, and that almost always when an ad is getting ready to be served up, that comes over lickety split. And then when you actually want to view the video you want to view, that goes slower. So I think sometimes it's how they prioritize handing out the video stream traffic.
Yeah, my problem was that I would get the beginning of the video, maybe the first, 20 or 30 seconds, and then the stream of it to me would just stall. And this was happening inside the YouTube app on the iPad, I guess at the time is what I had more problems with. But changing DNS often, though not always, helped. So, all right. Let's see. Now I need to get back to my agenda on my iPad now that I've lost all that, which is good. Right. Hey, I'm going to throw a cool stuff found in. Because it's up on my iPad screen right now. There's a lot of different services, for saving things to read later. There's Instapaper, which is really, really popular. And what these do is you're browsing the web or you see a link in your Twitter client or something. You say, I want to read this, but not now. And I want to read it later. And there was a service called Read It Later and there is a service called Instapaper. And you can kind of dump things to those and then download them into an app on your iPhone or your iPad or even onto your Mac and then read them later. And on your iPhone and iPad, you can read them offline, which is cool. Very, very, very cool. Makes it great for news junkies if you're kind of doing one thing and searching around and then later you want to go back and read maybe an article that was a little longer than your typical little news snippet. Well, Read It Later just, I think yesterday, maybe last night, changed their brand. And now it's called Pocket at getpocket.com. But man, this service is so cool because it's not just using, it doesn't just let you use articles. You can put videos and pictures and all kinds of things into your queue and then just kind of have them there. So it's really, really good stuff. And the UI on Pocket is so cool. I had used Read It Later a while back and kind of became an Instapaper guy, but Pocket has this killer UI. And there's even a way to import all your stuff from Instapaper if you decide, you're using one and you want to make the switch. Although I haven't done that yet, but I did start using it last night, and Pocket is free near as I can tell, though there may be a paid service. It might be kind of a freemium sort of thing, but it certainly works, and it's integrated well into a lot of different apps. Some of your apps on your iOS devices might still call it Read It Later, but it works with the new app, which is called Pocket. So I throw that in because it was up on my screen as I was getting back to our show notes. You ready to take Rowan, John?
You betcha.
All right.
And here's the question. Recently, I have been getting the error message, process picked D, quit unexpectedly. Just seems to occur randomly and occurs multiple times over a few minutes before going away. So far, I can't find any consistent cause, and I'm not using any particular software at the time, as far as I can tell. What is likely to trigger this particular process? So, and I actually found it. So, something with a D on the end is probably a Unix daemon or daemon. And as far as I can tell, both pronunciations are correct, depending on where you went to school or how long ago you started using Unix. But I found both pronunciations being used.
Yeah, and it regardless of pronunciation, a daemon is a...
Daemon.
Thank you. It's a process that is built to kind of sit as a almost as a server and do things and spit out results, if you will. Apache, which is a very, very popular web server, runs as a D process, right? I mean, it's MySQL, the server end of it, which is a database server, runs as a D process. So that's just one of those things.
So what I decided to try, so I'm like, that could be a Unix process. Well, let me go to the terminal and type man, which is manual page, and pick D and see what I come up with. And well, I thought that's a good general tip, but it didn't come up with anything very useful. It said, general helper tool. PicD is a helper tool for the Cocoa frameworks. There are no configuration options. Users should not run it manually. Okay, well, then I did a bit more digging, and it, and then the other thing I noticed is, oh, it has the word picked in there. Gee, you know, that may have something to do with pictures. And it does, indirectly, what it actually has to do with. So I did a bit more, Googling, and apparently what this is responsible for is generating quick look previews for picked images. Now, picked is a pretty old format, and not one that, as far as I know, I mean, you know, it's an old format, and I don't think anybody should really be using it. I suppose you can if you want, but
I think it was the first format for pictures on the Mac.
It could be, and I think some graphics and icons and stuff still could be in that format, but yeah. But anyways, here's what I came up with. So I wrote to Rowan and said, well, you know, it seems to have something to do with quick look previews. You know, do you have any picked files on your computer? Because maybe they're corrupt or something. And Rowan wrote back, and apparently that was it. And he says, oh, well, thank you. It was very interesting. You went one step deeper than I did and hit the nail on the head by doing a spotlight search for .picked. I got a whole bunch of clip art images in a Microsoft Office 2008 folder. Every time I did a search, as soon as the Finder window popped up, the error message would occur.
Cool.
So it seems that PicD, and apparently there's, I think, some sort of mismatch that we both found comments on this problem here. Let's see. PicD is used by the 64-bit OS to generate quick look images for the legacy 32-bit quick draw format. And I think he included an error report. But anyways, what he did was delete the .picked files because he didn't need them, and the problem seems to have gone away. So,
well, that's one way to solve it, right? That's good.
Yeah. I'll delete the files that causing the process to crash. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be interesting simply from a troubleshooting standpoint, not at all from a solving the problem and saving time standpoint, but it'd be interesting to find known good picked files and see if PicD still crashes. And if so, then there might be a problem with PicD on that machine. And maybe it's just corrupted and needs to be reinstalled, though. I think reinstalling it would mean reinstalling some portion of the OS, because I don't think Apple offers a standalone PicD installer. But you know, you could. There is a little Unix command. If you want to find out where something lives, you can. And this, I'll actually, I might have done this. Well, you can do this. So if you go onto your Mac into the terminal and type locate space, and then in this case, picked D, I believe if the locate database has not yet been built on your Mac, it will give you the command that you need to issue to build that. And then it will update it. I believe weekly is when it goes through and updates the locate database once it's built. But assuming it's been built, then on mine, at least on this Snow Leopard machine that I'm on, I can see that the PicD binary lives in /usr/sbin/PicD. So you could copy that from one Mac that's running the same OS over to yours and see if that helps. But there's also a plist file, John, in System Library Launch Agents called com.apple.picd.plist. Which really doesn't have any arguments other than to say, start up this service and sit there, wait for someone to need you. And that's what it does. Good stuff. Yeah, no. Yeah, I guess you could also use which from the Unix command line, right?
Oh.
WHICH. That's an interesting one because man, we're going into weird spots here, but that's good. It's geeky spots. So in Unix, you have when you type a command at the command line, it searches all of the things that are defined as your path or paths. When you log into a Unix machine, or when you fire up a terminal session, it sets all of these things for you, and you can edit your profile via the command line to set different directories to be searched. And so there's some default ones, and that's typically all you're going to need. But if you type which, WHICH, and then a command, it will tell you which command, if in case there are multiples, is the one you're going to run. And it might not be an obvious thing. You might have, you know, you might have downloaded something and it might be right there in the directory that you're in. But when you type which, it says, the system says, no, I'm going to go run this one over in user bin, because that's higher up in your path than whatever directory you're in. So you know, it's just another way to find commands is really the short way of saying that. So you can find out where it is, which picked D. And again, it shows me user sbin/picked D. So you could copy that from another Mac in theory. I don't know what that would, you know, if that would help or not, but it might be other libraries that it depends on. Good. Yeah.
Good.
All right. On to Todd. Should I
sure
reel myself back in here?
Yeah. Get back on track.
All right. Thanks.
Hi, Gabbers. ADD Todd here. Listening to your current freemium podcast, you're talking about Time Machine backups, which reminds me of a question that I need information on. I'm running a roughly 2008 MacBook. I've got a 160 gig drive in there. It's split into the drive and boot camp. My Time Machine backup is a 200 gig drive. I'm running out of space on there. Now, I've gone into Time Machine backups and let me give an example for today. Today I had 89 gig free. I went in, I deleted downloads and some other, emptied the directories of downloads and some other folders, then did a fresh start backup. And now I'm down to 60 some odd gig. I don't get it. I'm only using, I think I got it split to 100 for Mac and 60 gig for boot camp. I should be having a whole lot more free space. I'm only using 80 gig of my Mac. Can you help me out here? Currently, I'm in disk utility and clearing free space to see if that'll make a difference. I'm obviously not touching anything, so I went ahead and made the sparse image while it goes ahead and cleans out. I would prefer not to simply reformat and reuse as a backup because I may have documents and stuff that I'm not aware of that are not reflected on my Mac but are in my backup. Any help you can give me on the freemium, greatly appreciated. Not going to give you any personal details other than to say, and don't get caught. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Todd. So it very important to remember that Time Machine will not get smaller until it hits a wall, right? So your Time Machine backup will do nothing but grow in size until it hits a wall. And the reason for that is it's keeping all the old stuff that you may have deleted or may not have. So deleting something from, like you did, you emptied your downloads folder, won't go and delete that from your Time Machine backups automatically. We'll talk about a way of manually going in and doing that. But left to its own devices, Time Machine will just keep going and going and going. And even as it cleans itself out, it's going to leave space in there and because it knows it needs more. So it's going to go ahead and claim lots and lots of space right up until it runs out of it. And then it'll go back and start deleting some of the older stuff. So that's what you're seeing here. If you want to limit the amount of space that your Time Machine backup takes up, you have to limit the partition size that you allow it to see. Would you agree with that, John? Am I saying that right?
I think that's the only way you can do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So
otherwise, yeah, it consumes all resources eventually, just like computers.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Or software. Software will eventually consume all RAM and resources if you let it.
Well, if it's not written properly, software can be written to release RAM. I know you know this. Right. But here's an interesting thing. Your downloads folder. And I've done this, downloads folder is perhaps a unique example for you, Todd, but maybe not. But I've certainly done this when I've had virtual machines that take up gigabytes and gigabytes of space. And then I back them up and then I realize, you know, I don't want to be backing that up to Time Machine. And I go and exclude it in my Time Machine system preference. Well, that excludes it from all future backups. But if it's already been baked into a prior backup, it's going to stay out there until Time Machine decides that it's time to delete it. But you might want to go in and say, hey, I don't need this. It was just a default install of Windows. It's taking up 4.5 gigs in my backups, and I don't want to keep that around anymore. What you can do is you go into Time Machine by doing your standard enter Time Machine like you would to restore files and navigate in the Finder to the folder that you want to delete. And then you can, I believe, am I risky? No, I'm not going to do it here. I think you highlight the folder, and then I don't think it's a right click. I think you go at the top of the Finder window to the Time Machine menu, and you can choose, help me on this, John. Do you know it off the top of your head? I think it's Remove from Backups.
I'm firing up Time Machine on my machine now. It's taken a little while, but yeah, I thought it was in the Action menu, the little gear menu.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're pointing at a way to purge.
Yeah, it's in the Actions menu. That's right. It's in the Actions menu, and there is an option there to delete from the backup. I don't. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it's not a right click thing. But that will then delete all backups of anything that, you know, that's related, either a specific file, if that's what you're telling it, or that folder. It will delete any backups of that folder that you've ever made. And this can be really handy in a situation like Todd's, where he says, look, I don't need my backups folder in my backups anymore, so I'm going to go ahead and delete all of that stuff. But just by doing that won't necessarily compress down your sparse disk image, because the sparse images retain space, for lack of a more technical explanation, and will then fill that space as more stuff comes in. So they may not get smaller, or it might. It really depends on how the system chooses to manage that particular sparse image. And there's a lot of factors that go into that decision process. So do you have it, John? Are you there yet?
No.
Almost. Okay. All right.
Well, no, my machine just started doing a backup.
Oh, nice.
It's 10 o'clock. So.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. All right. Well, that's definitely where it is. You just can navigate to the folder and hit the gear menu and choose delete backup or delete from backup. Yeah.
I found an article here, and delete backup.
Okay, cool.
Or I think it's delete backup, and I think another thing is delete all. So I think you can either delete a specific one or all of them, right?
Yep. I think that's right. I think that's right, John. Yeah. And it'll ask you to confirm that, you know, are you sure you know what you're doing? And you say, yeah. And then it'll actually, you'll go back to your normal Finder interface, and you'll see a little progress bar similar to the one that you get when you do your first Time Machine backup. You'll see a little progress bar that says deleting from backup, and then it'll do its thing. That's how it works. All right. Eric has a common problem, or at least something that will lead us somewhere common with syncing your Google calendars. Eric writes, ever since I started using Apple's iCloud, I've lost my link to Google Calendar from my iPhone. Any suggestions as to how to reestablish this link without starting from scratch? Okay. I think in this case, starting from scratch is the only thing to do, but it's really not a big deal. Your Google Calendar exists out on the cloud. All you need to do is sync up your iPhone or iPad or any iOS device with it. So we'll just talk about how to do that. And I think, in fact, I know, because I heard back from Eric, that this will get you down that path. So what you're going to do is you're going to go to on your iPhone or your iPad, you go to Settings, and then Mail, Contacts, and Calendars. And then what you're going to do is you are going to, and I'm going to walk through this process so that we get this right. Go to Mail, Contacts, and Calendars. You click Add Account. This is interesting. You choose Microsoft Exchange. And then you put in your email address, and which would be your Gmail address or whatever your address is. Your username is also your email address. And then your password is whatever that is. And you can give it a description, whatever you like. At the moment, you can leave domain empty. Hit next. As soon as you do that, it's going to authenticate with the server, and then another field is going to pop up named server. In that server, you put in m.google.com. This is a very interesting thing. Once you've done that, then you will have a kind of a standard thing, but it'll be a standard little thing, and you get to choose whether you have mail, contacts, and or calendars synced. Depending on how you want to do things, you might want all of those. You might just want calendars. It depends on how you want to do it. This is only capable. You're only able to connect to m.google.com from mobile devices as an Exchange server. You can't connect to it as an Exchange server from your Mac. And I think that's a licensing thing between Google and Microsoft, actually, but for whatever it's worth. So in your case, just make sure you turn on at least calendars. Once you do that, then you'll want to go into your calendar on your iOS device and let it sync up. Here's the thing, though. It's only going to sync with your main Google Calendar the first time you do this. But it's important to do this because it gets kind of the foundation of the connection ready. Then, and you have to do this from your iOS device. You can't go to your Mac and do this next step. You have to stay on your iOS device. Go into Safari or whatever browser you want, but I've always done it with Safari. And go to m.google.com/sync, S-Y-N-C, and log in with the same Google account. When you do that, it will show you all of the iOS devices that you have ever connected to this account. And even though you may have sold them or destroyed them, they will all still be listed here, and there's nothing you can do to remove them. But it is what it is. Choose the iOS device that you just most recently synced, and it may not be easy because you might have, you know, if you've had a couple of iPhones in your life, you may just see iPhone, but look at the time that it was most recently synced. When you do that, it will show you a list of all of your calendars, and it'll give you some email settings at the top. You'll see that only one of your calendars is checked. Check all of the calendars that you want to appear on your iOS device and then hit save. Once you've done that, now you can go back into the calendar in iOS and it will resync with Google and pull down all of these other calendars. And then on your iOS device, you can choose whether or not to show them. But you have to go through this interim step of m.google.com/sync to manage this. Now, the good news is if you have an iPad, you can manage everything from there. You can manage all of your phones and all of that stuff, so you're not, you know, tapping buttons on your little iPhone screen. But you have to do it from some sort of iOS device in order for Google to let you do that. So that should get you back in business. A little quirky, but once you get it up and running, it works great. I love it. And I think you do the same thing, right, John?
Yeah, and that was the big head scratcher is unless you go to that Google Sync site, it appears that it's not working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know how. I'm sure I found it in some Google knowledge base. I mean, I obviously didn't stumble onto it. You know, that's one of those things someone has to tell you need to do. But I don't know why they don't tell you that, like, the moment that you connect. I don't know why you have to do this anyway. I mean, but whatever, you know, it is what it is. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But it does deserve a fist shake because it's, you know, the most unintuitive thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Well, maybe not that bad. Anything more on this, John? Mr. Braun? Can you still hear me, John? Or did we lose Skype connection? Folks, I think we've lost John. I'm going to put the show into pause here and we'll see where old Mr. Braun is. Are you back, John?
Yes.
All right. So what happened there?
Skype just totally wedged.
But then came.
And I thought my system locked up. Yeah, it was sitting there for like 30 seconds and then the system was totally unresponsive.
So is it that machine that was doing a backup? Is that right?
No.
Different machine doing the backup.
Right.
Okay. Because I'm just trying to think, you know, you're doing Skype. You've got Piezo running, which is saving to a local disk or a network drive?
Local.
Local for a backup recording.
No, I don't know what happened. I think it's the beta. I mean, the cursor was going, you know, things were happening in my menu bar. It was just, couldn't switch apps or anything. And then all of a sudden it came back. I'm surprised. Yeah, it didn't wedge like it did when, you know, there's a known issue between Skype and wiretap. Ah,
right. Yeah, interesting, fascinating. Well, it's good that it came back. Anything in your console logs? I mean, this is what we do. I wonder if it was a an interrupt thing where it just got so, you know, something was happening there and it just had to hang out, because audio, you know, obviously requires real time kind of access to the hardware, if you will.
Oh, great.
Oh, did I screw you up again by having you launch console?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just noticing all these. No, remember, I thought there was a problem. I had a piece of Parallels left over.
Oh, yeah.
I'm seeing this POSIX spawn error because, yeah, I don't think I totally cleaned that up.
You took out the files, but not the launch agent.
Or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, that's all I got in my console.
All right. Well, at least you're back. That's good.
Yes.
All right. Let's see. Let's go to. So did you have anything more to add on the Google Calendar sync thing, which was where we were when when this all went south? All right. Let's see. Going to Michael. He says, I have an early 2008 Mac Pro running Snow Leopard with 4 gigs of memory, a 750 gig boot drive, 2 1-gigabyte, 1 terabyte, I'm going to assume, drives. And my backup drive is a GTEC 3 terabyte FireWire drive. Once in a while, if I'm very lucky, I can click on an icon and the program loads. Most of the time, however, any icon I click on will not load. I have 3 backups on my GTEC drive: Time Machine, Super Duper, and Carbon Copy Cloner. I also have a crash plan backup in the cloud with some files, not the entire machine. I'm guessing this symptom means that my boot drive is hosed and I have to replace it. My question, if I do install a new hard drive and try to restore from Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner, can I be assured that these backups are good and will not restore a bad copy, giving me the same problems I have now? Interestingly, Time Machine will only back up once. When it tries to do it again, the icon just spins and there's no activity light flashing on my backup drive. Okay, so you definitely have a problem, but let's stipulate that. And while I'd be pretty sure, certainly if it's a hardware problem with that boot drive like you suspect, then certainly restoring from a backup wouldn't replicate the problem because you wouldn't be restoring to the same hardware. But of course, that's hard to say for certain because we don't know for certain that the hardware is the problem. To better confirm that it's the boot drive, the first thing, this could also be the result of file system corruption, which is different than disk corruption, as we talked about recently, right? So I would do a file system check, which you can do if it's, I think you said it, no, you're running Snow Leopard. So you got to do a single user startup, Command S. And then when that, it'll give you all your Unix stuff, and then it'll give you a command line. And right above that command line is a command description for FSCK. Type that whole thing in and then hit enter. And it will scan and, if necessary and if possible, fix the drive. And if it fixes it, it'll actually run a scan again. So I would do that first. And if it finds problems and is able to fix them and then scan clean, I would then try to reboot and see if everything works again. That might get you through this. If that doesn't do it, then I would do a hardware test on this, John. I'd scan that means a third party utility like Drive Genius, but you know, something to scan the disk to make sure that the disk actually has a problem. That would be my thought before you go out and spend money to replace the disk, but maybe you've got another disk and you can just, you know, do that with one of the others. That would be my thought. I don't know what your thoughts are, John. Maybe, hopefully you're still here.
It sounds like the one thing I would try, because it sounds like the problem is launching apps. So,
well, and also, I mean, I think it's bigger than that though, because he can't back up Time Machine a second time, which means, you know, the second time through, it's going to scan things. So that's what makes me start to think file system corruption, because it really relies on that type of stuff to figure out what to back up next.
The one thing I'd try, just to eliminate being, you know, something corrupt, get Onyx, go to the cleaning option, and there's, you know, a lot of caches there. I'm wondering if one of the caches is messed up. So I don't think it can hurt to try that first and see if that fixes any of these problems.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's good. Yeah, so that's what we got. All right, we have a couple of cool stuff found, and then we're out of here and we're gone for a week. So before we do the cool stuff found, a couple of things, very important. Number one, on Monday, which would be the 23rd, make sure you wish John a happy birthday. Right? That's right. I got that right, right?
Yep.
No, it's nice to have a birthday. It's a good thing. And then we'll be back the following week. Oh, I was going to ask you this after the show, but I might as well just ask you here in the middle of the show, John. Since I'm going to be away next week, and of course I'll get back to my desk Monday morning and be totally swamped, I would like to propose that we switch jobs for Mac Geek Gab 394. That being, you prepare the show and I'll do the show notes afterwards. Can we do that?
No.
Oh man, please.
Maybe I'll consider it.
Okay, cool. It's just easy. Just, you know, throughout the week, just go through the questions, queue them up, and then, you know, sort them into an agenda and we'll roll with it. I think it'll make us appreciate what each other does.
Mm-hmm.
So, that'd be great because that way it doesn't mean I have to, get back and like be buried in an avalanche of everything and at the same time prep a show. So that'd be awesome. All right. Anything else other than those two things? Cool stuff found. Right?
Go.
Okay. The first is from, well, I guess it's the second because I already did one. I slipped one in earlier without even planning it. Is Tom. And Tom writes, just a little iOS tip. One of the weaknesses of iOS is in mail and contacts. Specifically, iOS lacks mailing lists, which allow you to type the name of a list in the to field and an email is sent to everyone on that list. That's the groups in address book. And he's right. You can't send to a group with just one fell swoop. It says, as had been pointed out on your show a number of times, though, an email can be inserted into a field by typing an iOS shortcut. You go to Settings, General, Keyboard, Add New Shortcut. Type the shortcut letters into the shortcut field and the email address into the phrase field. But what many people might not know is that you can type a comma-separated list of email addresses in place of a single address. When you compose an email and type the shortcut in the to field, the comma-separated list appears. Hitting send leads iOS to warn you that the list is not a valid email address. If you ignore this warning and hit send anyway, the email is sent to everyone in the list. That's pretty cool. I like that. That's good stuff. I love the system-wide shortcuts on iOS. I wish they were more robust. Really, I wish that Apple would let third parties do things system-wide, but I get that, you know, that won't happen because then we could have Text Expander and really do it, you know, like the right way. But it's not going to happen. So at least I don't think so. Maybe if they buy Text Expander, that would be the only way it would happen. Another thing in Lion Mail, and this kind of came in answering a question for listener Austin, is that there's an interesting thing that is off by default in Lion's Mail. Of course, Lion's Mail has the new, it's not that new, but different from Snow Leopard, the different view by default. One thing that's not on by default, though, is if you go to Preferences, Viewing, there's a checkbox almost at the bottom that says include related messages, John. If you do this, what's awesome is it automatically, like if I sent you a message and then you replied to me, it would pull my message that I sent in below that. And if we had a trail back and forth, it would actually pull all of them in just to show it's not actually moving them to the inbox. In fact, it tells me what mailboxes those archives are all in. It might be in sent or it might be in saved or whatever, but it pulls them all in. So I don't have to go and find. And if the whole trail wasn't kept in our email, although you and I are really good about doing that, but some people aren't, it's really handy to see everything all there all at once. And if you have multiple people conversing, it just pulls it all together. Really, really handy stuff. So that's cool. Yeah. Some of you may hate that, of course, but it's good to know about and good to experiment with. So those are the two I had this week, John, or the two I'd seen. Do you have any?
No.
All right. Well, this has been your morning edition of Mac Geek Gab. No, that's good. I think we do good in the morning. It's nice. Keeps it fresh. A nice way to start.
I get the coffee.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I can't do caffeine. It's it makes me too crazy.
Yep.
Yep. All right. Let's see. Well, if you want to contact us, you, being our premium listeners, get to do that at premium@macgeekgab.com.
Mm-hmm.
You're not awake, are you? You gotta wake up, man. You were awake for the show. Now it's awake. Now it's time to sleep. Okay, good.
And I heard you say premium at MacGeekGab.com.
You're darn right. I said premium at MacGeekGab.com. That's the way we roll here. You can send, of course, text, email, picture. Well, it is email. Text, pictures, videos, whatever might help to solve the problem. One thing, you know, we had Marion earlier in the show who had emailed us. Actually, we talked about two of his questions, but there were three or maybe more. And he said at the bottom, sorry about putting these all into one email. They just sort of built up over time and then I sent it all at once. And that's, if you want to do that, that's fine. But I mean, I let you all in on a little secret about my workflow, certainly, and probably John's. When we're blasting through these to prep a show, the ones that are really long, I actually save and come back to later. Because if I'm in a time crunch to prep a show, much better to get through five questions than one, right? And so it was Marion's question that I came back to later, and I realized, actually, this is three or four separate questions. This is great. I can, you know, chunk this up or whatever. But it took me probably an extra couple of days or whatever to come back around to that. And so I said to Marion, if you just know that you can do it, however you want to send it is fine. But if you want, it would fit our workflow better if you actually sent each of those questions as an individual email, even if you did them all back to back to back. So I throw that out there just so you know how we're working. Again, if you wind up doing it all in one, it's fine. Just know that it might, you know, might fall not quite as high on our workflow as it would, but we'll get to it. Yeah, is that how you work through these two, John, or no?
I like little bite-sized chunks.
Yeah. Yeah, bite-sized chunks are good. All right. So that's that. 206-666-GEEK is the number to call. And of course, GEEK is, say it with me,
4335.
There you go. How else can they reach us here, John?
Skype to Mac Geek App.
That's right.
Facebook.com/MacGeekApp. Or Twitter to, well, Mac Geek App, if you'd like. On Twitter also, I am John Epron. He is Dave Hamilton. He who is not here is Pilot Pete. Or Mac Observer on Twitter as well.
Yeah, I think that does it. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston, of course, as always, every time, for converting this show into AAC for us and for you. Michael is also the host of We Have Communicators, which is a fantastic show about all things iOS that he does with some great guests. Most often he's got Adam Christensen and Jeff Gamet on there with him, but always adding other people in here and there too, which is awesome. So he does a great job with that show. Highly recommend you listen and tell them how much you love it. And then also Cachefly, CACHEFLY.com for all of your bandwidth from us to you. I think that does it. We're taking next week off, as we said. We'll be back on Monday the 30th to finish out April and see what agenda John has cooked up. Have fun and don't get caught.
Made up.